Olmsted, and Dr. Ian Telford, and it is the 10th. The 10th of all October. Yeah, I'm totally in control of this, you can see, okay? All right, let's start way back.
Way back.
Tell us about your childhood.
My childhood? Well, I was born in a private hospital in Milton, in Brisbane, because that was near my paternal grandparents' house.
Mm-hmm.
Raised in Holland Park in suburban Brisbane, which is then one of the outer suburbs. Now it's virtually an inner suburb. Went to primary school at the Holland Park State Primary School. Went to secondary school at Brisbane Grammar, and then to Queensland University, where I started out doing a degree in forestry, because in those days there weren't many botanical jobs around, there weren't many people employed by herbaria, and there was botany in the forestry course, well, to start with. But then I did well when there was botanical courses in it, got distinctions and so forth. But then in the second year, it started to be, no, the third year. The third and fourth year were done in Canberra at the forestry school, which was run by the various state forestry commissions. And then there were boring things like forest mensuration and so forth, which was of no interest. So I failed.
Can we just go back a step? Where did the interest begin?
Oh,
did you know from the very get-go?
When I was a boy, I used to collect bits and pieces and so forth. Yeah.
And
but I can't really remember when.
So you can't remember why you made the decision to go to university and do forestry?
Well, because...
because of the botany.
There was botany in the course.
Yeah.
Yes. And there was scholarships. Lots of scholarships were being given for forestry by the various state departments of forestry.
Mm-hmm.
And Queensland Forestry gave about 10 a year.
Oh, wow.
Now, of course, there's no such thing as the Queensland State Forestry Department, because it's all privatised. And all these millions of dollars spent in setting up plots to measure how fast trees grew and whatever were wasted, because most of the forests now are national parks, which is a good thing.
Okay, so failure at the end of year three, so what happened then? You failed the course.
So I was in Canberra, and...
Oh, so you'd gone to Canberra by then?
Yes, so the first 2 years were done at Queensland University.
Right, yep.
Yes, where I had a wonderful botany lecturer called Dr. Cribb. And he really... We used to go on field trips, and he really made me enthusiastic about Australian plants. And then the last 2 years have been done in Canberra at the Australian Forestry School.
Okay.
Which wasn't so exciting as doing the botanical bits up here. Anyhow, so I failed and paid my way out of my scholarship bond and got a job as a gardener at the, what was then the Canberra Botanic Gardens.
Okay.
As a gardener.
Right.
Anyhow, I only stayed in the garden for 3 or 4 months because I kept peering in through the herbarium window and eventually got inside there, and they saw I would probably be an asset to assembling the collection and naming the collection. So I started working in the herbarium. Yes, and still classified as a gardener. There were no technical positions in what was then the Parks and Gardens of the Australian Capital Territory Government. And now, of course, it's a federal concern. Anyhow, then it became the Australian National Botanic Gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there for 34 years.
Right.
Anyhow, great job, because I would go on several field trips a year to collect living material, cuttings, seeds, transplants for the living collection. And the botanist in charge of the herbarium and the gardens when I started was a Dr. Betty Phillips, who had done her PhD in ecology. Anyhow, she had this grand idea that all collections that were brought into the gardens to be grown had to have a voucher specimen collected with them. So that you collected the cuttings, you got a specimen, pressed it, dried it, and it went into the herbarium so that you could identify what you had collected from your voucher specimen. And this was before her time. I mean, some botanical gardens are doing it now, but not all. I won't mention names, but we had a case where there's this beautiful new species of herbalium growing in botanic gardens. Mm-hmm. They don't know where they collected it. And it's a new species.
Oh, no.
And we don't know where it's from.
Oh.
Anyway, and there are no other collections of it. Just this one collection that has the cuttings struck and they're growing in the botanic gardens.
Oh, so they are growing, at least.
Oh, yes. So we've got a living collection, but we don't know
where
it's native to.
Oh.
We don't know.
Oh. So is that a common... So now with the herbariums, the few that there are, you're telling me, they all have common collection ways of collecting and recording and...
No, they don't. I mean, with so many botanic gardens... Well, because the Australian National Botanic Gardens are purely... of native species.
Right.
Whereas others have to grow roses and showy things to keep the general public happy. Anyway, so you're just collecting native plants.
Right, okay.
And with 34 years collecting, you get to know the Australian flora.
So you must have travelled all over Australia, did you?
Yes. So I've been furthest west was Cocos Keeling Islands, which is a territory just south of Java.
Oh, Lord.
So that's in Australian territory.
Mm-hmm.
So there. And the most easterly were the Coral Cays of the Coral Sea.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
In the Coral Sea territory. I had to go to those because I was writing up for the Flora of Australia project, which we'll get onto later, the floras of the islands.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they hadn't been well collected. So,
right. So when you were doing all this for 34 years, were there weren't a lot of people doing the same thing, were there? How many of you were there, for example, in the herbarium in Canberra?
There were two botanists, and there were 6 or 7 gardeners, classified as gardeners, but they were doing... recording localities and writing and giving accession numbers and so forth, identifying plants. Yeah, so.
Okay, so because I noticed I don't know why I was looking at Te Papa this morning, and your name came up. Oh, maybe I put your name in for Te Papa. No, I wouldn't. I don't know. Anyway, the number, you've got 57 exhibits over there at Te Papa.
Oh.
With your name on them.
Oh.
I'll show you where to Google. Ooh, this boy gets around. Okay, so tell us the importance in your view, because I did read that the beetle one has 100,000 specimens. Is that right?
We've now got, by the time you weed out the things we've deaccessioned because they were poor specimens, in the early days, there was really no rigour to collecting. We're onto the NCW Beetle Herbarium now.
Yeah, yeah, sorry.
There was no rigorous way it was all done, and we're slowly bringing it into line with best practice. Well, Jeremy started it when he was appointed in 1993 as director.
Yep.
Yeah. And now we have Andrew Thornhill as the new director, and he's a moss enthusiast, so we're going to be building up an extensive moss collection as well as flowering plants and ferns.
Okay. Interestingly, we've just come back from Adelaide and we're at Carrick Hill yesterday and met a woman who is involved in the Diggers Club, and I don't know how we got onto the subject, but I said we were from Armidale, and she said, oh, well, you'll know about the Beadle Herbarium then, and I said, well, yes, we do, actually. And she said, oh, because their director is here tonight and he's talking to us about pollen. What are the chances?
That's why he was on the ABC the other morning.
Oh, that's who it was. Mm. So perhaps he could come and talk to us about pollens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
Interesting. So tell me why you think herbarium, I mean, this is stating the obvious, Ian, but I think it needs to be said. Tell me why herbariums are important.
Well, when they started out, of course, the dried specimens were important, and the living, because, I mean, things alter when they're pressed and dried, squashed flat, and lose their colour. So to have a living collection tied to that dried specimen is important for morphological studies,
sure.
Because before DNA sequence data was used for classification of plants, you had to depend on morphology. And we got it wrong so many times because of convergent evolution, parallel evolution, you get things looking the same, which really aren't related. And we've been led astray quite a few times. Anyhow, now that's all been rectified because they've slowly worked through the flowering plant kingdom and the ferns too, and worked out what's related to what. And so now it's almost all sorted out. But things keep changing. So when I was a boy, acacia belonged to the family Mimosaceae.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was put into the legumes, the big family Fabaceae, as a subfamily Mimosoideae. And DNA data showed, and the paper was published, a big collaboration doing so many species and genera, because it's a very large family, put in the subfamily Caesalpiniaceae, and Mimosaceae, Mimosoideae just doesn't exist anymore.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, okay, so there was some, I did Google you, I have to say, and I was very intrigued with what interests you most, because I did not understand any of them, which is, I guess. Hold on, let me find the piece of paper. Here we go. So,
this is the Botanic Garden site, National Botanic Garden site.
Yes. So you are, your main interests are in the biology, systematics, and biogeography of the one you just said, and that one, which I won't even try to. So can you explain, first of all, the systematics and the biogeography, what those terms mean?
Well, systematics is the arrangement, the way plants are related.
Mm-hmm.
So the species is in a genus is in a tribe, is in a subfamily, is in a family. And so that's the systematic arrangement of
the, so it's basically the structure. The
plant kingdom, yes. Yeah. Now, another part of it is taxonomy, which is the naming of plants, which is a different field. But, of course, the names are important because the generic name is repeated up the line. So the first genus named, if it gives the name to the family that is in. So at the moment, the legumes are called Fabaceae because the first genus named was Faba, the broad bean, by Linnaeus.
Yes, yes, yes.
So Faba gives rise to the name Fabaceae, because A-C-E-A-E is the family ending in Latin for the group. Now the problem is, when they started to investigate, broad bean is, Faba is not a good genus. Broad bean belongs to the genus Vicia, which is a common weed. You may have a little climbing thing with pinky purple flowers.
Yeah, yeah.
So
if you look at the flowers, they're just like a tiny broad bean flower.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the genus broad bean belongs to. But it looks so different because it's been selected over all the years of cultivation, because that was the bean of Europe. I mean, they didn't have The beans that came from America way, way back for thousands of years, they were growing broad beans. Anyhow, and mine are starting to pod at last.
Oh, it's...
I had my first ham and broad bean salad last night.
Oh, fantastic.
I don't bother waiting till they get big and you have to do this double peeling. That's boring.
Yeah, that's boring.
I pick them when they're that big and you cook them up with onion, garlic, sherry vinegar, chopped ham, and then hard-boiled egg stirred in, and beautiful.
That sounds fabulous. Okay, so biogeography.
Well, that's the distribution of plants, and yes.
Correct. Okay, so these two areas that are particularly interest you, can you explain what they are and why they interest you particularly?
Well, I'm particularly interested in what are called areas of endemism. So for some reason, there are special areas which are rich in species which are found nowhere else. And one of those, of course, is the New England tableland. So the granite outcrops of New England have a special flora. So one of the genera in particular is the genus Homeranthus, which is in the Myrtaceae. Virtually every granite outcrop has a different species sitting on it.
Really?
So in the past, there must have been a big ancestral species that was widespread across the tableland. As the tableland eroded and you got granite outcrops separated by clay soils, the things that grew on granite outcrops didn't like the clay soils, so they got restricted to there. And as the granite outcrops became separate, with genetic drift, they speciated and became separate species. Yeah. So that happens with Phobalium. So we've had Lachlan Copeland did his PhD in Homeranthus 30 years ago? No, not quite that, 20. And named so many new species from New England. And we are currently revising the genus Phobalium, and quite a few separate ones in New England that are sitting on granite outcrops. Baronia, again, closely related things, but they're sitting different enough to be called species, sitting on separate granite outcrops.
So it's a bit like the Galapagos Islands.
Sort of, yes, yes.
Yeah, developing species.
Except the sea is...
The sea is the...
The clay soil where the things that like rock outcrops can't grow. Yeah.
Okay. Alrighty, so... to me means cucumber, but it's not cucumber, is it?
Cucumis means cucumber.
Oh, it does, okay.
Yes, but so the salad cucumber is Cucumis sativa, which means edible. The rock melon is also a cucumis, and it's Cucumis mellow.
Wow.
And then in between you've got all sorts of little cucumbers, big cucumbers, little melons, big melons. In fact, the smallest cucumber grows in the Kimberley and on the Arnhem Land escarpment on rock outcrops. The fruit is about as big as your little fingernail and it contains 1 to 3 seeds.
That's amazing.
And I had the good fortune to name it.
Oh, fantastic. As you speak of naming, the little purple flower that's on the Welcome to Urella, that's named after you, isn't it?
Yes.
And where does that fit in? Why?
Well, the student was doing a PhD in the family Pittosporaceae. And the genus that belongs to, Chiranthera, is in Pittosporaceae. And that was one of her new species.
And she found it.
And I was with, I couldn't be called a supervisor. I was called an advisor. Because I didn't have a PhD, the Australian National University wouldn't let me be called a supervisor. So anyhow, she named it after me. And it's local. It's
I was going to say, where did you find it?
It's virtually confined to the Eurala Shire.
Ah.
So it grows...
That's perfect.
Mm.
Wow. Okay. All right. So...
It always grows where Mugga Ironbark is. So if you're going down the Bundara Road and you see an outcrop or a bit of a hill with Mugga Ironbark, at Christmas time, have a look around and you'll see this little twining thing to about that high with these beautiful deep blue flowers.
Oh, okay.
That's it.
Okay.
Sure. I haven't attempted to write down the botanical names, Ian. I think we'll have to do a transcript and come back to you. I'll ask our typist to just to do them as phonetically as best she can, because I'd be interrupting all the time to get the spellings.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you can have these as well. It might help. Just trying to pronounce them is enough of a challenge, I think.
So that was my master's, the Kupuma study.
Oh, okay. Mm.
And that's when I was working in collaboration with Maximilian University in Munich.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting because the professor of biology there, Dr. Suzanne Renner, had emailed me requesting leaf samples of a rare Australian cucurbit, which I had named. And I sent that to her, and I kept corresponding with her, and she had a series of PhD students working on the plant family Cucurbitaceae, and I got involved with each of those, and we named a new genus, Ostrobryonia, and quite a few new species of Cucumis. Yes.
Okay.
Good times.
Yes, excellent times. That's very interesting. So, are herbariums, are there, I'm trying to think how to put this. Are there enough herbariums in the world? Are you happy with the way the herbariums are developing, or is there something, are there any shortfalls that you know of?
Well, they're underfunded.
Yes.
I mean, we, University of New England, the NCW Beetle Herbarium, we've got the director.
Yeah.
We've got one technical person for 3 days a week.
Right.
Most of the work is done by volunteers. So I'm the honorary curator, which in other, even in other university herbaria, is a well-paid job. We've got the mounting of the specimens, of the dried specimens, done by volunteers. That's often done by volunteers, even at the state herbaria, because they're underfunded, of course. John Nevin,
yes,
whom you know, of course, is doing our photography.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mm.
Excellent. Because I think Philip Rose is a volunteer there, isn't he?
Yes, but he's hasn't been coming in with his medication affecting him.
Ah, right. Because he was seriously into she-oaks. She-oaks, yeah. Oh, that's no good. Okay. So, you retired, you said you retired from, when you moved up here when you retired, basically. We'll get to your private life in a minute. But so you moved up here and retired, and then how long have you been working at Beetle?
Well, I retired in stages, because Doug moved up here in 1997, and I kept going. I was virtually... I had a long service leave accrued, so I would come up here for a month or two on my long service leave, go back to Canberra and work for a month or two, staying with a friend who worked in the herbarium, come up here again. So I was commuting virtually for a couple of months at a time till my long service leave ran out. And that was building up my super, which was important. And then I retired in, I think, Must have been 1998, something like that.
Oh, wow.
Is it there?
No, no. Sorry, it is. In 1998, he retired from the herbarium to move to Armidale, misspelled.
And of course, I started doing the work up here that I'd been doing in Canberra.
Okay.
Which was curatorial work, naming, identifying plants in the collection and so forth. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just going to have to go and wipe my nose. Sorry.
Do you want me to stop and start? No, she's not going to be that long. Yes, I do apologise for not getting the botanical names down as we go.
That's all right, Liz.
But if you don't mind, I'll do my best and ask you to check them. I think that's probably the most accurate.
Mm.
And also some of the individuals' names.
So that brings us to the personal side, but also the garden side of the practical garden side of your life.
Well, the restoration of the garden started way, way back because Doug and his nephew David bought the homestead blocks from Graham, Doug's brother, who was the one slightly older than him, and then there was Ken, the eldest boy. They bought it in 1986, was it?
I don't have that, I'm sorry. But I'm sure we can...
1986, yes, it was 1986. And from then on, we realised, I mean, virtually there were no gardens. Fortunately, the box hedge had been retained. The old trees to the north had been retained, but all the gardens, all the gravel paths had all been grassed over. The courtyard out there was concreted over. The in-ground well, tank, it's a rainwater tank, had been filled in and concreted over. And there was a lot of work to do to bring the garden back looking like it's Victorian glory. Mm.
Probably need to state here now we're talking about the Bogarry homestead. Sorry, yeah. I didn't ask you to say what it was, where we are. So the actual garden, the original garden, went back how far?
Well, the house, the first part of the house was built in the 1870s,
right.
I think 1876, which was the cottage, four rooms with a veranda on the north side and the south side and a detached kitchen. And then they joined the kitchen to the house and put this wing in, so it became L-shaped. And then in 1900, I think, the bachelor's quarters cottage was built. So because their original house was a slab hut down by the creek in the gully, they had a track up to here where they were building their house. And the front garden was on the north side, so they planted it up in Victorian symmetry with the two funereal cypress and the two big photinia, and a circular garden paths and so forth. So that was on the north side. There were no photographs or people with alive who had a memory of the garden, because when Doug's grandfather took over, a fence was put along just off the north veranda, and where the trees were became the lamb's yard. Anyhow, when we were doing the restoration, you could see where the gravel paths had been because the grass wasn't doing so well. Because the soil was so shallow over it. And so we knew there was a circular bed, so we could restore it that way. And the main framework of the trees, the symmetry of the trees, was there still.
Okay, okay.
Now, when we were The vegetable garden was the first garden we restored because we knew it was there, had always been there, and in fact had been maintained as a vegetable garden, even though it had been let run down a bit until the 70s anyhow, the 1970s. But we didn't know how to go about restoring the garden. So because of the history of the house, with the original front garden on the north side, a garden developed here in later on, when the mail run came out from Urala and down to Bandara, this became the front. So this became the front garden. And then with the advent of the motor car, garages were built there, and everyone came through that gate. So that became the front garden. So we thought, we have to just have three front gardens, which is...
So you've become all things, all gardens to all people. That's
And there were photographs, and people remembered what the garden was like.
Oh, so they did.
Even though it had been grassed over,
yep,
and a single concrete path had been put through, and the box hedge was still there. There was flowering quince gone wild everywhere, but we cut that out and kept some bits of it, one as a dome to match the box dome at the other end of the garden.
So, when Doug and David, you know, bought the place, what stage, how long ago was that? Was that when you were still in Canberra?
Yes.
Yeah.
So Doug and I would come up for a few weeks at a time, bringing up truckloads of plants.
It's a surprise.
So when I was restoring the rose gardens, I would buy my roses from the Tumbarumba people.
Oh, yes.
Who ran a very good nursery and had beautiful plants, and they were grown on basalt, so they did very well here. Whereas the South Australian were on a different rootstock. I think they were on Dr. Huey,
yes,
and didn't do as well on the basalt soil.
That's interesting, isn't it? So it became, you could see where you wanted to go. Did you sit down and say, okay, this is what we're going to do, or did it kind of develop over the years? Did you imagine when you started what would happen?
Well, we put the paths in. We knew where we wanted the paths
to
be. So
from the beginning you had the paths.
Well, we knew what the paths would be like here and there. Now, we had this huge clump of bamboo. What to do with it? Because it sends out rhizomes. Mm. Anyhow, we got Darryl in his bobcat to rip out half of it, which is now the white garden.
Yep.
That used to be all bamboo. And then he knocked a path through the middle of it. And we're slowly keeping it confined. Tim, our gardener, has just dug a trench on this side of it because it's contained on the western side, but on the eastern side it sends rhizomes along under the flowering quince, which is a nuisance. But he's slowly taming it. So, but we have to keep it because it was an important part of the original garden, and is a source of stakes. I mean, we use it for stakes. I'm cutting bean poles at the moment for the climbing beans I'll be putting in when the frosts are finished. Maybe they're finished by this.
Possibly.
Some years they finish very early, and you could have put in tomatoes or beans by this stage. But it's hard to tell.
It is. Because you think, oh yeah, it's all over Red Rover, and then suddenly, bang, you get one frost and out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So then you were generous enough to open the garden to the public for fundraising activities. Did you enjoy doing that? Was there a reward in it for you?
Yes. I always enjoyed showing people around. I mean, it was a bit of a chore having to do the weeding and get it all neat and tidy to have them open, but very rewarding. Yeah.
And do you think that it seems to me there are, you know, obviously fewer and fewer gardens opening, but surely it must be important to continue to do so, because otherwise nobody's going to know what gardening's about if they don't see how to do it, or what to do, or where to do. Yeah.
Well, we get requests every now and then for, can we bring in a tour? And we say yes, or David says yes, it's his garden.
Okay, you. Okay, well, I don't have any more questions. Liz, is there something, anything I've missed that we haven't talked about?
Well, we haven't talked about the roses and how we had the 1919 planting list.
Oh, yes.
In Doug's grandfather's journal.
That's right.
There were 32 roses listed. And of those, when we started restoring the garden, we could get 13 of them. Mostly they were teas, a few were hybrid perpetuals, and there was La France, which was a hybrid tea, but I think there might have been a few more hybrid teas, but mostly they were teas. One from the 1919 planting is still alive. Down there was planted in 1919.
Wow. And what about Madame Leone here? How old is she?
I got that and put it in. That'd be close on 35 years old.
Wow. That's magnificent.
The drought nearly killed her, but she's come back. She's about to bloom, which is good.
Yeah, well, she's on it. It's fantastic.
Souvenir de Madame Leone Bigano.
I'd like to throw in a question about your later study, Ian, because I think after retirement you went a full circle back to academia. Is that correct?
Well, when I retired up here and started doing the same work I'd been doing in the herbarium in Canberra, after a while Jeremy said, "You're doing all this work, why don't you do it towards something?" He said, "Do a master's." So I had done in Canberra before I had retired, even though I didn't have a degree, I was able to do a graduate diploma, which gave me a leg into doing a master's and a PhD. So,
which is where the doctor came from.
So I under Jeremy, I started doing a master's in the Cucurbitaceae, in the genus Cucumis, and then that went well. I got funding to do that, and I did very well with that, so I got a PhD scholarship, so I did a PhD on the family Philanthaceae, which you probably haven't heard of.
No.
You may have heard of the family Euphorbiaceae.
Oh, yes.
Well, Philanthaceae is one of the splits from Euphorbiaceae. Euphorbiaceae was split up into 4 families, I think, when they did the DNA analyses, yes.
Okay.
And I worked on a little genus called Sauropus, which turned out not to be the correct name because there was an earlier name, Cynostemon, which they were all transferred to. So I named, 12 new species of Cynostemon for my PhD. And this was the masters had been working with the students at Munich. So I did the morphological work and they did the DNA work. So we collaborated like that. Okay. The same thing happened with my PhD. I did the morphological work and they did the molecular work, the DNA extraction and sequencing and so forth, which works very well because to extraction of DNA and the sequencing is quite expensive. And UNE doesn't have the facilities, you would have to pay a lot to do it. So to do this collaborative work is such a good thing to do. Anyhow. And now I've got this collaboration with the university in Paris, which
just because there are a number, you've just told us, collaboration in Paris, but also other places as well. Didn't you say?
Yeah, there was Leiden University in Holland, in the Netherlands, which was with the master's. With the PhD, sorry. That was the Philanthesi.
Right.
Yes. And then before that, Maximilian University of Munich was with the Cucumis.
Okay.
For the master's.
Right.
Yes.
So tell us now about what's about to happen about with this event that's about to happen that you and Jeremy are being recognised in.
Well, it's supposed to be secret until it's announced at the conference.
That's okay. This won't come out.
That's right.
So, most botanists in Australia are members of the, and New Zealand too, are in the Australasian Systematic Botany Society. And every year there's a conference which is held at various State of Barrier or universities. We held one here in 2009, and this year, the first week of November, we're holding it again in 2025. This year, it's called the Next Gen Conference. Now, Next Gen has a double barrel meaning, because Next Gen is a way of sequencing.
Oh, okay.
But it's also next generation of botanists coming on.
Yes.
So it's concentrating on early career botanists and students.
Oh, wow.
And so the three keynote speakers are, in fact, early career botanists, including our own Helen Kennedy, who graduated with her PhD 2 years ago.
Right.
Hmm.
Wow. So, but they're coming from how far afield?
Well,
attendees, I mean.
When we had ours here, we brought in a keynote speaker from the Missouri Botanic Gardens, and took him on a field trip to Point Lookout, where we saw a rare climbing plant he'd only ever read about, and here it was in full bloom. He was so beside himself to see this. Anyway, so this year we're running the field trip goes to Dorigo, so we're doing a rainforest trip there.
Oh.
Visiting the gorges on the way, so we go to Wollombi and Ebor Falls as well.
So roughly how many people are you expecting?
Oh, 150 or so, I should
say. Oh, wow.
Maybe not quite that many.
Right. Mm. So are there enough young botanists coming on, in your opinion? Is it the interest still there, or is it waning?
There's so much work still to be done in Australia. I mean, Jeremy and I have been listed in northeastern New South Wales and adjacent southern Queensland, and we have probably 80 or so new species still to name that we know of. That's looking at the morphology. That's not without DNA sequencing, which will yield more. So there was you might know the P genus Pultaneo, which is eggs and bacon.
Yes.
Which
lovely. Is flowering now.
It's flowering now. Anyhow, there was a study done 20 years ago using no DNA data, just the morphology, and one species that was treated in that revision yielded 19 species with the DNA sequencing, and they're quite different, different habitats, different morphologies, but they looked similar enough for the botanist back then to lump them all together.
Mm. Wow.
So.
Okay. I think we're done. Thank you very much for that.
Thank
that was
you,
fascinating.
Ian.
Which is in what used to be the family Apacridaceae. Now it's in the family Ericaceae, subfamily Apacridoideae. Anyhow, Melicris was last revised by a student at UNE in 1957. And the student was Betsy Patterson, who went on to be come Betsy Jakes when she married and became Professor of Botany at James Cook University, Townsville. Anyhow, Betsy's still alive, and Helen, on one of her field trips, met Betsy, and they talked, which was nice.
Yes.
And she's naming, Helen is naming a New England species, one of her new species, after Betsy.
Oh, lovely.
Mm. So it was nice to have the tradition continuing that a UNE student is revising Mellicus after all these years.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm.
That's terrific.
I thought I should have get that in there because I think it's important.
Should we talk a bit about, I've just realised I'm not mentioning who Doug was. That was, I should have clarified that. Do you want to give us a little brief about the Moffat family? And because it wasn't just the Moffat family that was tied up with, it was another family as well, wasn't there?
The Mitchells.
The Mitchells, yes.
Yes.
Can you just give us a wee potted history of the Moffats and the Mitchells and how they've interacted over the years? Is it too hard? No?
Well, the only relevance is really that the Mitchells planted the original front garden and designed the house.
Oh, okay. Mm.
I mean, the dates and so forth don't really matter.
Okay.
I don't think so.
Okay. No problem. Should we take a wee stroll around the garden? Would that be okay?
Sounds wonderful.
And would you like a cup of tea later on or coffee?
I'm perfectly flexible in that. I wonder if you could give us a little bit more of a virtual walk around the Invergowrie Garden with the historical specimens of note, like we mentioned the Isabella grape when we were outside.
Yes, we did.
Yes, so along the eastern veranda, the Mitchells had planted Isabella grapes along a trellis, which has the roofline follows down along the top beam of the trellis, which Darrell repeated when he replaced it there. The trellis eventually fell down, and instead of replanting the grapes, rebuilding the trellis and replanting the grape vines were chopped out. Anyhow, in restoring the garden, the trellis was put in. There were photographs of the trellis, so we knew what it was like, and it was restored fairly early on in the piece with cuttings of the Isabella grapes from Salisbury Court, which may have been the source of the Mitchell cuttings because the families are related.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of her name. The wife who bought the cuttings out.
Marsh.
Thank you.
She married a Marsh. She was sorry, it's gone. It'll come back.
Right. It was a Marsh that brought her. That's the story that I've heard from.
Yes.
From Sally.
That's right. So the source of some of the plants here, like the Fritinia and the funeral cypress,
they may have been bought from a nursery in Armidale, because so many plants around Armidale are about the same age, and particularly Central Park. I mean, they would have had a nursery going to grow the plants for Central Park, surely. And maybe they had additional ones that they... Because the bunyas, the two big bunyas, date from the 1870s.
When the house was built, or the first portion.
Or maybe a little later, when the mail run came down and the driveway was put in. I'm not quite sure how the... I don't know if the record... There must be records of when the post office was established. There was a post office in the bachelor's quarters.
Yes.
And the mail coach used to come down and stop there.
And it was called the bachelor's quarters because...
That's where the male children,
yeah,
because there were 13 children in the Mitchell family.
That's quite a few.
Which was too many for this little house.
Okay. But not atypical of the time. Now, is there anything else in the garden of particular note that we may not have discussed in?
Oh, I think we've done the Rose List.
Yes.
Yes.
We've done the Buxus, we've done the front garden, the vegetables.
Well, the garden's pretty well been covered, I think. Yeah.